smaller sense of his android servants, so that on some days he clashes with himself and his environment simultaneously. Nor is his appearance limited to sartorial chaos. King William moves in a permanent sphere of dishabille, his fly unsealed, his velvet cape torn and tattered, and drawing crumbs magnetically from the floor, his left sleeve ruffle twice as long as the right, which, in turn, looks as if it has been dipped in jam. You get the idea. For all this, Sad King Billy has an insightful mind, and a passion for the arts and literature, which has not been equaled since the true Renaissance days on old, old Earth. In some ways, King Billy is the fat child with his face eternally pressed to the candy store window. He loves and appreciates fine music, but cannot produce it. A connoisseur of ballet and all things graceful, His Highness is a klutz, a moving series of pratfalls and comic bits of clumsiness. A passionate reader, unerring poetry critic, and patron of forensics, King Billy combines a stutter in his verbal expression with a shyness which will not allow him to show his verse or prose to anyone else. A lifelong bachelor, now entering his 60th year, King Billy inhabits the tumble-down palace and 2,000-square-mile kingdom as if it were another suit of rumpled royal clothes. Anecdotes abound. One of the famous oil painters whom King Billy supports finds His Majesty walking head down, hands clasped behind him, one foot on the garden path and one in the mud, obviously lost in thought. The artist hails his patron. Sad King Billy looks up, blinks, looks around as if awakening from a long nap. "Excuse me," His Highness says to the bemused painter, but could you please tell me, was I headed toward the palace or away from the palace?"
"Toward the palace, Your Majesty," replies the artist.
"Oh, good," sighs the king, "then I've had lunch."
General Horace Glennonhite had begun his rebellion, and the outback world of Asquith lay directly in his path of conquest. Asquith was not worried. The hegemony had offered a force space fleet as a shield, but the royal ruler of the kingdom of Monaco in exile seemed more melted than ever when he called me in.
"Martin," said His Majesty, "you've heard about the battle for Fomalhaut?"
"Yeah," I said. "It doesn't sound like anything to worry about. Fomalhaut was just the kind of place Glennonhite's been hitting. Small, no more than a few thousand colonists, rich in minerals, and with a time debt of at least, 20 standard months from the web?"
23, said Sad King Billy. "So you don't think that we are in jeopardy?"
"Uh-huh," I said. "With only a 3-week real transit time and a time debt of less than a year, the hegemony can always get forces here from the web faster than the general can spin up from Fomalhaut."
"Perhaps," mused King Billy, beginning to lean on a globe and then jumping upright as it started to turn under his weight. "But nonetheless, I've decided to start our own modest hegira."
I blinked, surprised. Billy had been talking about relocating the kingdom in exile for almost 2 years, but I had never thought he would go through with it.
The ships are ready on Parvati," he said. "Asquith has agreed to provide the transport we need to the web."
"But the palace," I said, "the library, the farms, and the grounds."
"Donated, of course," said King Billy. "But the contents of the library will travel with us."
I sat on the arm of the horsehair divan and rubbed my cheek. In the 10 years I had been in the kingdom, I had progressed from Billy's subject of patronage to tutor, to confidant, to friend. But never did I pretend to understand this disheveled enigma. Upon my arrival, he had granted me an immediate audience. "Do you wish to join the other talented people in our little colony?" he had asked. "Yes, Your Majesty." "And will you write more books like the Dying Earth?" "Not if I can help it, Your Majesty." "I read it, you know," the little man had said. "It was very interesting." "You're most kind, sir."
"B-b-b-bullshit, M. Silenus."
"It was interesting because someone had obviously bowdlerized it and left in all the bad parts." I had grinned, surprised by the sudden revelation that I was going to like Sad King Billy.
"But the Cantos," he sighed, "that was a book. Probably the finest volume of poetry published in the web in the last 2 centuries.
How you managed to get that by the mediocrity police, I will never know. I ordered 20,000 copies for the kingdom." I bowed my head slightly, at a loss for words for the first time since my post-stroke days 2 decades before. "Will you write more poetry like the Cantos?"
"I came here to try, Your Majesty."
"Then welcome," said Sad King Billy. "You will stay in the west wing of the castle, near my offices, and my door will always be open to you." Now I glanced at the closed door and at the little sovereign, who, even when smiling, looked as if he were on the verge of tears. "Hyperion?" I asked. He had mentioned the colony world gone primitive many times. "Precisely. The android seed ships have been there for some years, Martin, preparing the way, as it were." I raised an eyebrow. King Billy's wealth came not from the assets of the kingdom, but from major investments in the web economy. Even so, if he had been carrying on a surreptitious recolonization effort for years, the cost must have been staggering.
Do you remember why the original colonists named the world Hyperion, Martin?"
"Sure. Before the Hegira, they were a tiny freehold on one of the moons of Saturn. They couldn't last without terrestrial resupply, so they emigrated to the outback and named the survey world after their moon." King Billy smiled sadly. "And do you know why the name is propitious for our endeavor?" It took me about 10 seconds to make the connection.
"Keats," I said.
Several years earlier, near the end of a long discussion about the essence of poetry, King Billy had asked me who was the purest poet who had ever lived.
"The purest," I had said. "Don't you mean the greatest?"
"No, no," said Billy, "that's absurd to argue over who is the greatest. I'm curious about your opinion of the purest, the closest to the essence you describe." I had thought about it a few days and then brought my answer to King Billy as we watched the setting suns from the top of the bluff near the palace. Red and blue shadows stretched across the amber lawn toward us.
"Keats," I said.
"John Keats," whispered Sad King Billy.
"Ah."
And then a moment later,
"Why?"
So I had told him what I knew about the 19th-century old earth poet, about his upbringing, training, and early death, but mostly about a life dedicated almost totally to the mysteries and beauties of poetic creation. Billy had seemed interested then. He seemed obsessed now as he waved his hand and brought into existence a hollow model which all but filled the room. I moved backward, stepping through hills and buildings and grazing animals to get a better view.
"Behold, Hyperion!"
whispered my patron. As was usually the case when he was totally absorbed, King Billy forgot to stutter. The hollow shifted through a series of views, River cities, port cities, mountain areas, a city on a hill filled with monuments to match the strange buildings in the nearby valley.
The Time Tombs? I said.
Precisely. The greatest mystery in the known universe. I frowned at the hyperbole.
They're fucking empty, I said. They've been empty since they were discovered.
They are the source of a strange anti-entropic force field, which lingers still, said King Billy. One of the few phenomena outside singularities which dares to tamper with time itself.
It's no big deal, I said. It must have been like painting rust preventative on metal. They were made to last, but they're empty. And since when do we go bug-fuck about technology?
Not technology, sighed King Billy, his face melting into deeper grooves. Mystery. The strangeness of place, so necessary to some creative spirits. A perfect mixture of the classical utopia and the pagan mystery.
I shrugged, not impressed.
Sad King Billy waved the hollow away.
Has your poetry improved?
I crossed my arms and glared at the regal dwarf slob.
No.
Has your muse returned?
I said nothing.
If looks could have killed, we would all be crying, "The king is dead, long live the king," before nightfall.
Very well, he said, showing that he could look insufferably smug as well as sad.
Pack your bags, my boy. We're going to Hyperion.
Fade in. Sad King Billy's five seed ships floating like golden dandelions above a lapis sky. White cities rising on three continents. Keats, Endymion, Port Romance. The poet city itself. More than 8,000 of art's pilgrims seeking escape from the tyranny of mediocrity and searching for a renewal of vision on this rough-hewn world. Asquith and Windsor in exile had been a center for android biofacture in the century following the Hegira, and now these blue-skinned friends of man labored and tilled with the understanding that once these final labors were finished, they were free at last. The white cities rose. The indigenes, tired of playing native, came out of their villages and forests and helped us rebuild the colony to more human specifications. The technocrats and the bureaucrats and ecocrats were thawed and let loose upon the unsuspecting world, and sad King Billy's dream came one step closer to reality. By the time we arrived at Hyperion, General Horace Glennonhite was dead, his brief but brutal mutiny already crushed, but there was no turning back. Some of the more rugged artists and artisans spurned the poet city and eked out rugged but creative lives in Jacktown or Port Romance, or even in the expanding frontiers beyond, but I stayed. I found no muse on Hyperion during those first years. For many, the expansion of distance because of limited transportation, EMVs were unreliable, skimmers scarce, and the contraction of artificial consciousness due to the absence of datasphere, no access to the all-thing, and only one fatline transmitter, all led to a renewal of creative energies, a new realization of what it meant to be human and an artist. Or so I heard. No muse appeared. My verse continued to be technically proficient and dead as Huck Finn's cat. I decided to kill myself. But first I spent some time, 9 years at least, carrying out a community service by providing the one thing New Hyperion lacked. Decadence. From a biosculptor, aptly named Grauman Hackett, I obtained the hairy flanks, hooves, and goat legs of a satyr. I cultivated my beard and extended my ears, Grauman made interesting alterations to my sexual apparatus. Word got around. Peasant girls, indigenes, the wives of our true blue city planners and pioneers, all awaited a visit from Hyperion's only resident satyr, or arranged one themselves. I learned what priapic and satyriasis really mean. Besides the unending series of sexual contests, I allowed my drinking bouts to become legendary, and my vocabulary to return to something approaching the old post-stroke days. It was fucking wonderful. It was fucking hell. And then, on the night I had set aside to blow my brains out, Grendel appeared. Notes for a sketch of our visiting monster. Our worst dreams have come alive. Something wicked shuns the light. Shades of Morbius and the Krell. Keep the fires high, Mother. Grendel comes tonight. At first, we think the missing are merely absent. There are no watchers on the walls of our city. No walls, actually. No warriors at the door of our mead hall. Then, a husband reports a wife who disappears between the evening meal and the tucking in of their two children. Then, Hoban Christus, the abstract implosionist, fails to appear at midweek performance at Poets Amphitheater, his first missed cue in 82 years of treading the boards. Concern rises. Sad King Billy returns from his labors as overseer on the Jacktown restoration and promises that security will be tightened. A sensor net is woven around the town. Ship security officers sweep the time tombs and report that all remains empty. Mechs are sent into the labyrinth entrance at the base of the Jade Tomb and report nothing in a 6,000-kilometer probe. Skimmers, automated and manned, sweep the area between the city and the bridal range and sense nothing larger than the heat signature of a rock eel. For a local week, there are no more disappearances. Then the deaths begin. The sculptor Pete Garcia is found in his studio, and in his bedroom, and in the yard beyond. Ship security manager Truen Hines is foolish enough to tell a news teep, "It's like he was mauled by some vicious animal, but no animal I've ever seen could do that to a man." We were all secretly thrilled and titillated. True, the dialogue is bad, straight out of a million movies and hollies we've scared ourselves with, but now we are part of the show. Suspicion turns toward the obvious. A psychopath is loose among us, probably killing with a pulse blade or hell whip. This time he, or she, had not found time to dispose of the body. Poor Pete. Ship security manager Hines is sacked, and city manager Pruitt receives permission from His Majesty to hire, train, and arm a city police force of approximately 20 officers. There is talk of truth-testing the entire Poet City population of 6,000. Sidewalk cafes buzz with conversation of civil rights. We were technically out of the hegemony. Did we have any rights? And harebrained schemes are hatched to catch the murderer. Then the slaughter begins. There was no pattern to the murders. Bodies were found in twos and threes, or alone, or not at all. Some of the disappearances were bloodless, others left gallons of gore. There were no witnesses, no survivors of attacks. Location did not seem to matter. The Wymott family lived in one of the outlying villas, but Sarah Robb never stirred from her tower studio near the center of town. Two of the victims disappeared alone, at night, apparently while walking in the Zen garden. But Chancellor Lehman's daughter had private bodyguards, yet vanished while alone in a bathroom on the 7th floor of Sad King Billy's palace. On Lussus, or Tau Ceti Center, or a dozen other of the old web worlds, the deaths of 1,000 people add up to minor news. Items for the datasphere short term, or the inside pages of the morning paper. But in a city of 6,000, on a colony of 50,000, a dozen murders, like the proverbial sentence to be hanged in the morning, tend to focus one's attention wonderfully well. I knew one of the first victims. Sisyphus Harris had been one of my first conquests as a satyr, and one of my most enthusiastic. A beautiful girl. Long blonde hair, too soft to be real. A fresh-picked peach complexion, too virginal to dream of touching. A beauty, too perfect to believe. Precisely the sort that even the most timid male dreams of violating. Sisyphus now had been violated in earnest. They found only her head, lying upright in the center of Lord Byron's plaza, as if she had been buried to her neck in pourable marble. I knew when I heard these details precisely what kind of creature we were dealing with. For a cat I had owned on Mother's estate had left similar offerings on the south patio most summer mornings. The head of a mouse, staring up from the sandstone in pure rodent amazement. Or perhaps a ground squirrel's toothy grin. Killing trophies from a proud but hungry predator. Sad King Billy came to visit me while I was working on my cantos. "Good morning, Billy," I said. "It's Your Majesty," grumped His Majesty in a rare show of royal pique. His stutter had disappeared the day the royal dropship landed on Hyperion. "Good morning, Billy, Your Majesty." Growled my liege lord, moving some papers and managing to sit in the only puddle of spilled coffee on an otherwise dry bench. "You're writing again, Silenus." I saw no reason to acknowledge an acknowledgment of the obvious. "Have you always used a pen?" "No," I said, "only when I want to write something worth reading." "Is that worth reading?" He gestured toward the small heap of manuscript I had accrued in 2 local weeks of work. "Yes." "Yes, just yes." "Yes." "Will I get to read it soon?" "No." King Billy looked down and noticed that his left leg was in a puddle of coffee. He frowned, moved, and mopped at the shrinking pool with the hem of his cape. "Never," he said. "Not unless you outlive me." "Which I plan to do," said the king, "while you expire from playing goat to the kingdom's ewes." "Is that an attempt at a metaphor?"
"Not in the least," said King Billy. "Merely an observation.
I haven't forced my attentions on a ewe since my boyhood days on the farm," I said. "I promised my mother in song that I wouldn't indulge in sheep-fucking again without asking her permission." While King Billy looked on mournfully, I sang a few bars of an ancient ditty called "There'll Never Be Another You."
"Martin," he said, "someone or something is killing my people."
I set aside my paper and pen.
"I know," I said. "I need your help."
"How, for Christ's sake? Am I supposed to track down the killer like some HTV detective? Have a fight to the fucking death on Reichenbach fucking Falls?"
"Oh, that would be satisfactory, Martin. But in the meantime, a few opinions and words of advice would suffice."
"Opinion one," I said. "It was stupid to come here. Opinion two, it's stupid to stay. Advice Alpha Omega, leave."
King Billy nodded dolefully.
"Leave this city or leave all of Hyperion?"
I shrugged.
His Majesty rose and walked to the window of my small study. It looked out across a 3-meter alley to the brick wall of the automated recycling plant next door. King Billy studied the view. "You're aware," he said, "of the ancient legend of the Shrike?"
"I've heard bits of it."
"The indigenes associate the monster with the time tombs, he said. The indigenes smear paint on their bellies for the harvest celebration and smoke unrecombinant tobacco, I said. King Billy nodded at the wisdom of this. He said, The Gemini First Down team was wary of this area. They set up the multi-channel recorders and kept their bases south of the bridle. Look, I said, Your Majesty, what do you want? Absolution for screwing up and building the city here? You're absolved. Go and sin no more, my son. Now, if you don't mind, your royal ship, adios, I've got dirty limericks to write here. King Billy did not turn away from the window. You recommend that we evacuate the city, Martin. I hesitated only a second. Sure. And would you leave with the rest? Why wouldn't I? King Billy turned and looked me in the eye. Would you? I said nothing. After a minute, I looked away. I thought so, said the ruler of the planet. He clasped his pudgy hands behind his back and stared at the wall again. If I were a detective, he said, I would be suspicious. The city's least productive citizen starts writing again after a decade of silence, only... What, Martin? 2 days after the first murders happened? Now he's disappeared from the social life he once dominated and spends his time composing an epic poem. Shy. Even the young girls are safe from his goatish ardor. I sighed. Goatish ardor, my lord. King Billy glanced over his shoulder at me. All right, I said, you've got me. I confess. I've been murdering them and bathing in their blood. It works as a fucking literary aphrodisiac. I figure 200-300 more victims tops, and I'll have my next book ready for publication. King Billy turned back to the window. What's the matter? I said. Don't you believe me? No. Why not? Because, said the king, I know who the murderer is. We sat in the darkened hollow pit and watched the shrike kill novelist Sarah Robb and her lover. The light level was very low. Sarah's middle-aged flesh seemed to glow with a pale phosphorescence, while her much younger boyfriend's white buttocks gave the illusion in the dim light of floating separately from the rest of his tanned body. Their lovemaking was reaching its frenzied peak when the inexplicable occurred. Rather than the final thrusts and sudden pause of orgasm, the young man seemed to levitate up and backward, rising into the air as if Sarah had somehow forcefully ejected him from her body. The soundtrack on the disc, previously consisting of the usual banal pants, gasps, exhortations, and instructions one would expect from such activity, suddenly filled the hollow pit with screams. First the young man's, then Sarah's. There was a thud as the boy's body struck a wall off camera. Sarah's body lay waiting in tragically comic vulnerability, her legs wide, arms open, breasts flattened, thighs pale. Her head had been thrown back in ecstasy, but now she had time to raise it, shock and anger already replacing the oddly similar expression of imminent orgasm. She opened her mouth to shout something. No words. There came the watermelon-carving sound of blades piercing flesh, of hooks being pulled free of tendon and bone. Sarah's head went back, her mouth open impossibly wide, and her body exploded from the breastbone down. Flesh separated as if an invisible axe were chopping Sarah Robb for kindling. Unseen scalpels completed the job of opening her, lateral incisions appearing like obscene time-lapse footage of a mad surgeon's favorite operation. It was a brutal autopsy performed on a living person. On a once-living person, rather, for when the blood stopped flying and the body ceased spasming, Sarah's limbs
relaxed in death. Legs opening again in an echo of the obscene display of viscera above. And then, for the briefest second, there was a blur of red and chrome near the bed. "Freeze, expand, and augment," King Billy told the house computer. The blur resolved itself into a head out of a Jolt Addict's nightmare. A face part steel, part chrome, and part skull. Teeth like a mechanized wolf's crossed with a steam shovel. Eyes like ruby lasers burning through blood-filled gems. Forehead penetrated by a curved spike blade rising 30 centimeters from a quicksilver skull. And a neck ringed with similar thorns. "The Shrike?" I asked. King Billy nodded, the merest movement of chin and jowls. "What happened to the boy?" I asked. "There was no sign of him when Sira's body was discovered," said the king. "No one knew he was missing until this disc was discovered. He's been identified as a young recreation specialist from Endymion." "You just found the hollow?" "Yesterday," said King Billy. "The security people found the imager on the ceiling, less than a millimeter across. Sira had a library of such discs. The camera apparently was there only to record, the bedroom follies," I said, "precisely." I stood up and approached the floating image of the creature. My hand passed through forehead, spike, and jaws. The computer had calculated its size and represented it properly. Judging from the thing's head, our local Grendel stood more than 3 meters tall. "Shrike," I muttered, more in greeting than in identification. "What can you tell me about it, Martin?" "Why ask me?" I snapped. "I'm a poet, not a mytho-historian." "You accessed the seedship computer with a query about the Shrike's nature and origins." I raised an eyebrow. "Computer access was supposed to be as private and anonymous as datasphere entry in the hegemony." "So what?" I said. "Hundreds of people must have checked out the Shrike legend since the killings began. Maybe thousands. It's the only fucking monster legend we've got." King Billy moved his wrinkles and folds up and down. "Yes," he said, "but you searched the files 3 months before the first disappearance." I sighed and slumped into the hollow pit cushions. "All right," I said, "I did. So what? I wanted to use the fucking legend in the fucking poem I'm writing, so I researched it. Arrest me." "What did you learn?" I was very angry now. I stamped satyr hooves into the soft carpet. "Just the stuff in the fucking file," I snapped. "What in the hell do you want from me, Billy?" The king rubbed his brow and winced as he accidentally stuck his little finger in his eye. "I don't know," he said. "The security people wanted to take you up to the ship and put you on full interrogative interface. I chose to talk to you instead." I blinked, feeling a strange zero-G sensation in my stomach. Full interrogative meant cortical shunts and sockets in the skull. Most people interrogated that way recovered fully. Most. "Can you tell me what aspect of the Shrike legend you plan to use in your poem?" King Billy asked softly. "Sure," I said. "According to the Shrike cult gospel that the indigenes started, the Shrike is the Lord of Pain and the Angel of Final Atonement, come from a place beyond time to announce the end of the human race." I liked that conceit. "The end of the human race," repeated King Billy. "Yeah, he's Michael the Archangel, and Moroni, and Satan, and Masked Entropy, and the Frankenstein monster, all rolled into one package," I said. "He hangs around the time tombs, waiting to come out and wreak havoc when it's mankind's time to join the dodo and the gorilla and the sperm whale on the extinction hit parade list." "The Frankenstein monster," mused the short little fat man in the wrinkled cape. "Why him?" I took a breath. Because the Shrike cult believes that mankind somehow created the thing, I said, although I knew that King Billy knew everything I knew and more. Do they know how to kill it? He asked. Not that I know of. He's supposed to be immortal, beyond time. A god? I hesitated. Not really, I said at last. More like one of the universe's worst nightmares come to life, sort of like the Grim Reaper, but with a penchant for sticking souls on a giant thorn tree, while the people's souls are still in their bodies. King Billy nodded. Look, I said, if you insist on splitting hairs from backworld theologies, why don't you fly to Jacktown and ask a few of the cult priests? Yes, said the king, chin on his pudgy fist, obviously distracted. They're already on the seed ship being interrogated. It's all most confusing. I rose to leave, not sure if I would be allowed to. Martin? Yeah? Before you go, can you think of anything else that could help us understand this thing? I paused in the doorway, feeling my heart batting at my ribs to get out. Yeah, I said, my voice only marginally steady. I can tell you who and what the Shrike really is. Oh? It's my muse, I said, and turned and went back to my room to write. Of course, I had summoned the Shrike. I knew that. I had summoned it by beginning my epic poem about it. In the beginning was the word. I retitled my poem The Hyperion Kantos. It was not about the planet, but about the passing of the self-styled titans called humans. It was about the unthinking hubris of a race which dared to murder its home world through sheer carelessness, and then carried that dangerous arrogance to the stars, only to meet the wrath of a god which humanity had helped to sire. Hyperion was the first serious work I had done in many years, and it was the best I would ever do. What began as a comic serious homage to the ghost of John Keats became my last reason for existence, an epic tour de force in an age of mediocre farce. Hyperion Kantos was written with a skill I could never have attained, with a mastery I could never have gained, and sung in a voice which was not mine. The passing of humankind was my topic. The Shrike was my muse. A score more people died before King Billy evacuated the City of Poets. Some of the evacuees went to Endymion or Keats or one of the other new cities, but most voted to take the seed ships back to the web. King Billy's dream of a creative utopia died, although the king himself lived on in the gloomy palace at Keats. Leadership of the colony passed to the Home Rule Council, which petitioned the hegemony for membership and immediately established a self-defense force. The SDF, made up primarily of the same indigenes who had been cudgeling each other a decade before, but commanded now by self-styled officers from our new colony, succeeded only in disturbing the peacefulness of the night with their automated skimmer patrols and marring the beauty of the returning desert with their mobile surveillance mechs. Surprisingly, I was not the only one to stay behind. At least 200 remained, although most of us avoided social contact, smiling politely when we passed on Poet's Walk, or while we ate apart in the echoing emptiness of the dining dome. The murders and disappearances continued, averaging about one a local fortnight, although they were usually discovered not by us, but by the regional SDF commander, who demanded a headcount of citizens every few weeks. The image that remains in my mind from that first year is an unusually communal one. The night we gathered on the commons to watch the seed ship leave. It was at the height of the autumn meteor season, and Hyperion's night skies were already ablaze with gold streaks and red crisscrosses of flame when the seed ship's engines fired. A small sun flared, and for an hour we watched as friends and fellow artists receded as a streak of fusion flame. Sad King Billy joined us that night, and I remember that he looked at me before he solemnly re-entered his ornate coach to return to the safety of Keats. In the dozen years which followed, I left the city only half a dozen times. Once to find a biosculptor who could rid me of my satyr affectation, the other times to buy food and supplies. The Shrike Temple had renewed the Shrike pilgrimages by this time, and on my trips I would use their elaborate avenue to death in reverse. The walk to Kronos Keep, the aerial tram across the bridle range, the wind wagons, and the Charon barge down the Hooghly. Coming back, I would stare at the pilgrims and wonder who would survive. Few visited the City of Poets. Our half-finished towers began to look like tumbled ruins. The gallerias, with their splendid metal-glass domes and covered arcades, grew heavy with vines. Pyreweed and scargrass poked up between the flagstones. The SDF added to the chaos, setting mines and booby traps to kill the Shrike, but only succeeding in devastating once beautiful sections of the city. Irrigation broke down. The aqueduct collapsed. The desert encroached. I moved from room to room in King Billy's abandoned palace, working on my poem, waiting for my muse. When you think about it, the cause-effect begins to resemble some mad logic loop by the data artist Carolus, or perhaps a print by Escher. The Shrike had come into existence because of the incantatory powers of my poem, but the poem could not have existed without the threat presence of the Shrike as muse. Perhaps I was a bit mad in those days. In a dozen years, sudden death culled the city of dilettantes until only the Shrike and I remained. The annual passage of the Shrike pilgrimage was a minor irritation, a distant caravan crossing the desert to the time tombs. Sometimes a few figures returned, fleeing across Vermilion Sands to the refuge of Kronos Keep, 20 kilometers to the southwest. More often, no one emerged. I watched from the shadows of the city. My hair and beard had grown until they covered some of the rags I wore. I came out mostly at night, moving through the ruins like a furtive shadow, sometimes gazing at my lighted palace tower like David Hume, peering in his own windows and solemnly deciding that he wasn't home. I never moved the food synthesizer from the dining dome to my apartments, preferring instead to eat in the echoing silence under that cracked duomo like some addled Eloy fattening himself up for the inevitable Morlock. I never saw the Shrike. Many nights, just before dawn, I would awaken from a nap at a sudden sound, the scratch of metal on stone, the rasp of sand under something's foot. But although I was often sure that I was being watched, I never saw the Watcher. Occasionally I made the short trip to the Time Tombs, especially at night, avoiding the soft, disconcerting tugs of the anti-entropic time tides, while I moved through complicated shadows under the wings of the Sphinx or stared at stars through the emerald wall of the Jade Tomb. It was upon my return from one of these nocturnal pilgrimages that I found an intruder in my study. "Impressive, Martin," said King Billy, tapping one of several heaps of manuscript which lay about the room. Seated in the oversized chair at the long table, the failed monarch looked old, more melted than ever. It was obvious that he had been reading for several hours. "Do you really think that mankind deserves such an end?"
he asked softly. It had been a dozen years since I had heard the stutter. I moved away from the door but did not answer. Billy had been a friend and patron for more than 20 standard years, but at that moment I could have killed him. The thought of someone reading Hyperion without permission filled me with rage.
"You date your Kantos?"
said King Billy, riffling through the most recent stack of completed pages. "How did you get here?" I snapped. It was not an idle question. Skimmers, dropships, and helicopters had not had much luck flying to the Time Tombs region in recent years. The machines arrived sans passengers. It had done wonders in fueling the Shrike myth. The little man in the rumpled cape shrugged. His uniform was meant to be brilliant and regal, but merely made him look like an overweight harlequin. "I followed the last batch of pilgrims," he said, "and then came down from Keep Kronos to visit. I noticed that you've written nothing in many months, Martin. Can you explain that?" I glowered in silence while sidling closer. "Perhaps I can explain it," said King Billy. He looked at the last completed page of Hyperion Kantos as if it had the answer to a long puzzled riddle. "The last stanzas were written the same week, last year, that J.T. Tilio disappeared." "So?" I had moved to the far edge of the table now. Feigning a casual attitude, I pulled a short stack of manuscript pages closer and moved them out of Billy's reach. "So that was, according to the SDF monitors, the date of the death of the last remaining Poet City dweller," he said. "The last, except for you, that is, Martin." I shrugged and began moving around the table. I needed to get to Billy without getting the manuscript in the way. "You know, you haven't finished it, Martin," he said in his deep, sad voice. "There is still some chance that humanity survives the fall." "No," I said and sidled closer. "But you can't write it, can you, Martin? You can't compose this poetry unless your muse is shedding blood, can you?" "Bullshit," I said. "Perhaps, but a fascinating coincidence. Have you ever wondered why you have been spared, Martin?" I shrugged again and slid another stack of papers out of his reach. I was taller, stronger, and meaner than Billy, but I had to be sure that none of the manuscript would be damaged if he struggled as I lifted him out of his seat and threw him out. "It's time we did something about this problem," said my patron. "No," I said, "it's time you left." I shoved the last stacks of poetry aside and raised my arms, surprised to see a brass candlestick in one hand. "Stop right there, please," King Billy said softly, and lifted a neural stunner from his lap. I paused only a second, then I laughed. "You miserable little hangdog fraud," I said. "You couldn't use a fucking weapon if your life depended on it." I stepped forward to beat him up and throw him out. My cheek was against the stone of the courtyard, but one eye was open enough for me to see that stars still shone through the broken latticework of the Galleria dome. I could not blink. My limbs and torso tingled with the pinpricks of returning sensation, as if my entire body had fallen asleep and was now coming painfully awake. It made me want to scream, but my jaw and tongue refused to work. Suddenly, I was lifted and propped against a stone bench so that I could see the courtyard and the dry fountain, which Rithmet Corbett had designed. The bronze Laocoon wrestled with bronze snakes in the flickering illumination of the pre-dawn meteor showers. "I'm sorry, Martin," came a familiar voice, "but this madness has to end." King Billy came into my field of view carrying a tall stack of manuscript. Other heaps of pages lay on the shelf of the fountain at the foot of the metal Trojan. An open bucket of kerosene sat nearby. I managed to blink. My eyelids moved like rusted iron. "The stun should wear off any minute," said King Billy. He reached into the fountain, raised a sheaf of manuscript, and ignited it with a flick of his cigarette lighter. "No!" I managed to scream through clenched jaws. The flames danced and died. King Billy let the ashes drop into the fountain and lifted another stack of pages, rolling them into a cylinder. Tears glistened on lined cheeks illuminated by flame. "You called it forth," gasped the little man. "It must be finished." I struggled to rise. My arms and legs jerked like a marionette's mishandled limbs. The pain was incredible. I screamed again, and the agonized sound echoed from marble and granite. King Billy lifted a fat sheaf of papers and paused to read from the top page. "Without story or prop but my own weak mortality, I bore the load of this eternal quietude, the unchanging gloom, and the three fixed shapes, ponderous upon my senses a whole moon. For by my burning brain I measure sure her silver seasons, shedded on the night, and ever day by day I thought I grew more gaunt and ghostly. Oftentimes I prayed, intense, that death would take me from the veil and all its burdens, gasping with despair of change. Hour after hour I cursed myself." King Billy raised his face to the stars and consigned this page to flame. "No!" I cried again, and forced my legs to bend. I got to one knee, tried to steady myself with an arm ablaze with pinpricks, and fell on my side. The shadow in the cape lifted a stack too thick to roll and peered at it in the dim light. Then I saw a wan face not pinned by human sorrows, but bright blanched by an immortal sickness which kills not. It works a constant change, which happy death can put no end to. Deathwards, progressing to no death, was that visage. It had passed the lily and the snow, and beyond these I must not think now, though I saw that face. King Billy moved his lighter, and this and 50 other pages burst into flame. He dropped the burning papers into the fountain and reached for more. "Please," I cried, and pulled myself up, stiffening my legs against the twitches of random nerve impulses while leaning against the stone bench. "Please." The third figure did not actually appear, so much as allow its presence to impinge upon my consciousness. It was as if it always had been there, and King Billy and I had failed to notice it, until the flames grew bright enough. Impossibly tall, four-armed, molded in chrome and cartilage, the shrike turned its red gaze on us. King Billy gasped, stepped back, and then moved forward to feed more Kantos to the fire. Embers rose on warm drafts. A flight of doves burst from the vine-choked girders of the broken dome with an explosion of wing sound. I moved forward in a motion more lurch than step. The shrike did not move, did not shift its bloody gaze. "Go!" cried King Billy, stutter forgotten, voice exalted, a blazing mass of poetry in each hand. "Return to the pit from whence you came!" The shrike seemed to incline its head ever so slightly. Red light gleamed on sharp surfaces. "My lord!" I cried. Although to King Billy, or the apparition from hell, I did not know then, and know not now. I staggered the last few paces and reached for Billy's arm. He was not there. One second, the aging king was a hand's length from me, and in the next instant He was 10 meters away, raised high above the courtyard stones. Fingers, like steel thorns, pierced his arms and chest and thighs. But he still writhed, and my Kantos burned in his fists. The shrike held him out like a father offering his son for baptism. "Destroy it!" Billy cried, his pinned arms making pitiful gestures. "Destroy it!" I stopped at the fountain's edge, tottered weakly against the rim. At first, I thought he meant destroy the shrike. And then I thought he meant the poem. And then I realized that he meant both. 1,000 pages and more of manuscript lay tumbled in the dry fountain. I picked up the bucket of kerosene. The shrike did not move, except to pull King Billy slowly back against his chest in an oddly affectionate motion. Billy writhed and screamed silently as a long steel thorn emerged from his harlequin silk just above the breastbone. I stood there stupidly and thought of butterfly collections I had displayed as a child. Slowly, mechanically, I sloshed kerosene on the scattered pages.
"End it," gasped King Billy. "Martin, for the love of God!"
I picked up the lighter from where he had dropped it. The shrike made no move. Blood soaked the black patches of Billy's tunic until they blended with the crimson squares already there. I thumbed the antique lighter once, twice, a third time, sparks only. Through my tears I could see my life's work lying in the dusty fountain. I dropped the lighter. Billy screamed. Dimly I heard blades rubbing bone as he twisted in the shrike's embrace.
"Finish it," he cried. "Martin! Oh, God!"
I turned then, took 5 fast paces, and threw the half-full bucket of kerosene. Fumes blurred my already blurred vision. Billy and the impossible creature that held him were soaked like 2 comics in a slapstick holly. I saw Billy blink and splutter. I saw the slickness on the shrike's chiseled muzzle reflect the meteor-brightened sky, and then the dying embers of burned pages in Billy's still-clenched fists ignited the kerosene. I raised my hands to protect my face. Too late. Beard and eyebrows singed and smoldered, and staggered backward until the rim of the fountain stopped me. For a second, the pyre was a perfect sculpture of flame. A blue and yellow Pietà with a 4-armed Madonna holding a blazing Christ figure. Then the burning figure writhed and arched, still pinned by steel thorns and a score of scalpeled talons, and a cry went up which to this day I cannot believe emanated from the human half of that death-embraced pair. The scream knocked me to my knees, echoed from every hard surface in the city, and drove the pigeons into wheeling panic. And the scream continued for minutes after the flaming vision simply ceased to be, leaving behind neither ashes nor retinal image. It was another minute or two before I realized that the scream I now heard was mine. Anticlimax is, of course, the warp and way of things. Real life seldom structures a decent denouement. It took me several months, perhaps a year, to recopy the kerosene-damaged pages and to rewrite the burned Kantos. It will be no surprise to learn that I did not finish the poem. It was not by choice. My muse had fled. The city of poets decayed in peace. I stayed another year or two, perhaps 5, I do not know. I was quite mad by then. To this day, records of early shrike pilgrims tell of the gaunt figure, all hair and rags and bulging eyes, who would wake them from their Gethsemane sleep by screaming obscenities and shaking his fist at the silent time tombs, daring the coward within to show itself. Eventually the madness burned itself out, although the embers will always glow. And I hiked the 1,500 kilometers to civilization. My backpack weighted down with just manuscript, surviving on rock eels and snow, and on nothing at all for the last 10 days. The 2.5 centuries since are not worth telling, much less reliving. The Poulsen treatments to keep the instrument alive and waiting. 2 long, cold sleeps in illegal sublight cryogenic voyages, each swallowing a century or more, each taking its toll in brain cells and memory. I waited then. I wait still. The poem must be finished. It will be finished. In the beginning was the word. In the end, past honor, past life, past caring. In the end will be the word.
Four. The Benares put into Edge a little after noon on the next day. One of the mantas had died in harness, only 20 kilometers downriver from their destination, and A. Betic had cut it loose. The other had lasted until they tied up to the bleached pier, and then it rolled over in total exhaustion, bubbles rising from its twin air holes. Betic ordered this manta cut loose as well, explaining that it had a slim chance of surviving if it drifted along in the more rapid current. The pilgrims had been awake and watching the scenery roll by since before sunrise. They spoke little, and none had found anything to say to Martin Silenus. The poet did not appear to mind. He drank wine with his breakfast and sang bawdy songs as the sun rose. The river had widened during the night, and by morning it was a 2-kilometer-wide highway of blue-gray cutting through the low green hills south of the sea of grass. There were no trees this close to the sea, and the browns and golds and heather tones of the main shrubs had gradually brightened to the bold greens of the 2-meter-tall northern grasses. All morning the hills had been pressed lower, until now they were compressed into low bands of grassy bluffs on either side of the river. An almost invisible darkening hung above the horizon to the north and east. And those pilgrims who had lived on ocean worlds and knew it as a promise of the approaching sea had to remind themselves that the only sea now near was comprised of several billion acres of grass. Edge never had been a large outpost, and now it was totally deserted. The score of buildings lining the rutted lane from the dock had the vacant gaze of all abandoned structures, and there were signs on the riverfront that the population had fled weeks earlier. The Pilgrim's Rest, a 3-century-old inn just below the crest of the hill, had been burned. A. Betic accompanied them to the summit of the low bluff.
"What will you do now?"
Colonel Cassad asked the android.
"According to the terms of the Temple Bondature, we are free after this trip. We shall leave the Benares here for your return and take the launch downriver, and then we go on our way."
"With the general evacuations?"
asked Braun Lamia.
"No,"
Betic smiled.
"We have our own purposes and pilgrimages on Hyperion."
The group reached the rounded crest of the bluff. Behind them, the Benares seemed a small thing tied to a sagging dock. The Hooli ran southwest into the blue haze of distance below the town and curved west above it, narrowing toward the impassable lower cataracts 12 kilometers upriver from Edge. To their north and east lay the sea of grass.
"My God,"
breathed Braun Lamia. It was as if they had climbed the last hill in creation. Below them, a scattering of docks, wharves and sheds marked the end of Edge and the beginning of the sea. Grass stretched away forever, rippling sensuously in the slight breeze and seeming to lap like a green surf at the base of the bluffs. The grass seemed infinite and seamless, stretching to all horizons and apparently rising to precisely the same height as far as the eye could see. There was not the slightest hint of the snowy peaks of the Bridal Range, which they knew lay some 800 kilometers to the northeast. The illusion that they were gazing at a great green sea was nearly perfect, down to the wind-ruffled shimmers of stalks, looking like white caps far from shore.
"It's beautiful,"
said Lamia, who had never seen it before.
"It's striking at sunset and sunrise,"
said the consul.
"Fascinating,"
murmured Saul Weintraub, lifting his infant so that she could see. She wiggled in happiness and concentrated on watching her fingers.
"A well-preserved ecosystem,"
Hetmastine said approvingly.
"The Muir would be pleased."
"Shit,"
said Martin Silenus. The others turned to stare.
"There's no fucking wind wagon,"
said the poet. The four other men, woman, and android stared silently at the abandoned wharves and empty plain of grass.
"It's been delayed,"
said the consul. Martin Silenus barked a laugh.
"Or it's left already. We were supposed to be here last night."
Colonel Cassad raised his powered binoculars and swept the horizon.
"I find it unlikely that they would have left without us. The wagon was to have been sent by the Shrike Temple priests themselves. They have a vested interest in our pilgrimage."
"We could walk," said Lenar Hoyt. The priest looked pale and weak, obviously in the grip of both pain and drugs, and barely able to stand, much less walk.
"No. It's hundreds of clicks, and the grass is over our heads."
"Compasses."
"Compasses won't work on Hyperion,"
said Cassad, still watching through his binoculars. "Direction finders, then."
"We have an IDF, but that isn't the point,"
said the consul.
"The grass is sharp. Half a click out, and we'd be nothing but tatters."
"And there are the grass serpents,"
said Cassad, lowering the glasses.
"It's a well-preserved ecosystem, but not one to take a stroll in."
Father Hoyt sighed and half collapsed into the short grass of the hilltop. There was something close to relief in his voice when he said, "All right, we go back." A. Betic stepped forward.
"The crew will be happy to wait and ferry you back to Keats in the Benares, should the wind wagon not appear." "No. Take the launch and go."
"Hey, just a fucking minute. I don't remember electing you dictator, amigo. We need to get there. If the fucking wind wagon doesn't show, we'll have to find another way."
The consul wheeled to face the smaller man.
"How? By boat? It takes 2 weeks to sail up the main and around the north littoral to Otho or one of the other staging areas. And that's when there are ships available. Every seagoing vessel on Hyperion is probably evolved in the evacuation effort."
"Dirigible, then,"
growled the poet. Braun Lamia laughed.
"Oh, yes. We've seen so many in the 2 days we've been on the river."
Martin Silenus whirled and clenched his fists, as if to strike the woman. Then he smiled.
"All right then, lady. What do we do? Maybe if we sacrifice someone to a grass serpent, the transportation gods will smile on us."
Braun Lamia's stare was arctic.
"I thought burned offerings were more your style, little man."
Colonel Cassad stepped between the two. His voice barked command.
"Enough! The consul's right. We stay here until the wagon arrives. M. Mistine, M. Lamia, go with A. Bedek to supervise the unloading of our gear. Father Hoyt and M. Silenus will bring some wood up for a bomb."